integrated simulations required in the training syllabus, what the crew didn't need was a team of controllers who couldn't respond correctly to an emergency. Kranz was beginning to doubt his own abilities. One day, late in June, Armstrong and Aldrin stood side by side in the lunar module simulator, descending to a simulated moon. The pitch-over maneuver came right on time. Aldrin scanned the gauges and called out data on altitude and speed. Armstrong surveyed the moon for a landing spot. Suddenly, it all went bad. The attitude indicator began to tumble. A thruster had stuck on. Aldrin looked out and saw the moonscape tilting crazily, looming ever larger. He was sure that if they continued the descent, they would be killed, but Armstrong did not abort. Aldrin hesitated to tell his commander what to do, but he felt like a helpless passenger in an Indy race car. At last, he said, through clenched teeth, "Neil, hit abort!" Finally, Houston gave the order, "Apollo 11, we recommend you abort," but it was too late. The TV image of the moon froze, and the gauges ceased changing, and Aldrin knew he and Armstrong were scattered across the moon in 1,000 pieces. He looked over at Armstrong, who was still absorbed in the problem. That evening, Aldrin and Collins were having a nightcap in the living room of the crew quarters. While Collins sipped a beer, Aldrin dipped into a bottle of scotch and began to let off steam about the morning's simulated disaster. Everyone had been listening, he told Collins, and Armstrong knew that, and yet he hadn't aborted. In fact, he'd been indecisive, and this was going to be recorded as a crew failure. As the scotch bottle emptied, Aldrin's voice grew louder and more strident. Suddenly a door opened, and there was Armstrong, in his pajamas, a frosty look on his face. "You guys are making too much damn noise out here," he said. Aldrin realized he had heard every word. Collins excused himself and went to bed, leaving his crewmates to their discussion. Aldrin talked it out with his commander. Armstrong said he didn't think anyone would see the incident as a black mark on the crew. By the next day, all seemed forgotten, but Aldrin could not deny that a certain coolness had set in between himself and Armstrong since the whole business about who would be first man out of the LM, and this had not improved things any. Armstrong, for his part, wasn't concerned about having crashed in an integrated simulation. In truth, he'd thought the exercise had been a good test of the mission control and was anxious to see how they would handle it, and they hadn't. As for being indecisive, he was testing his own limits and abilities in the one place where he could safely afford to. After all, you couldn't kill yourself in the simulator. Meanwhile, throughout the spring of 1969, Mike Collins was waging his own battle for mastery of the command module simulator. If Armstrong and Aldrin had the landing to worry about, then Collins had just about everything else, for the command module pilot's job now included, in addition to navigation, being in charge of the burns into and out of lunar orbit, as well as the re-entry into the Earth's atmosphere. Collins, too, fell prey to a team of ruthless simulator instructors, and when he made a mistake, it meant being stranded in lunar orbit, burning up in the Earth's atmosphere, or plummeting into the ocean with parachutes still packed away. By June, Collins was steeling himself for the final weeks of battle. He would master his command module and his mission, and that was all there was to it. Collins had joined the lunar landing crew after the most difficult episode of his career. He recovered from surgery in time to help send his former crewmates to the moon. As Borman, Lovell, and Anders spoke from lunar orbit, Collins listened from mission control and felt a special connection to events and a special envy. When Apollo 8 splashed down, Collins stood amid cheers, waving flags and cigar smoke, and was overcome by emotion. Leaving mission control, he shed his tears in private. Now, on the lunar landing mission, Collins would have the role of staying behind in lunar orbit while his crewmates made history. Fully aware of how people expected him to feel, he told interviewers with complete honesty that he felt no frustration. He was going 99.9% of the way, he said, and that was fine with him. But in joining the crew of Apollo 11, Collins had taken his place among two men who were in many ways his opposite. He was as easygoing as Aldrin was serious, as accessible as Armstrong was remote. Alone among the three, he professed no love of machines. He barely tolerated the computers that had taken over spaceflight. The instructors would hear his voice from inside the simulator. "All I do is punch buttons." Collins's tastes ran toward fine wines and good books. He dabbled in oil painting and cultivated roses in his Houston garden. To reporters faced with Armstrong's inscrutability, Aldrin's technical relentlessness, Collins was a breath of fresh air. He fielded their queries with good humor. His face seemed to say that, yes, these are interesting questions. When asked, he did his best to explain his two crewmates. He spoke of Armstrong's almost towering intelligence and his sly wit, and said with a smile, "He has his own barriers erected." In truth, Collins admired Armstrong and Aldrin for their brilliance and technical skills, and felt fortunate to be flying with them, but he wished he knew them better. He lamented the fact that the three of them seemed to communicate only about technical information. Even now, after months of training together, he felt he barely knew them. He liked Armstrong, but didn't know how to close the distance his commander kept. Aldrin, as Collins would later write, is more approachable. In fact, for reasons I cannot fully explain, it is me that seems to be trying to keep him at arm's length. I have the feeling that he would probe me for weaknesses, and that makes me uncomfortable. But Collins understood that close friendship was not required to fly a good mission. What was required, in his case, was knowing how to rescue Armstrong and Aldrin if they got into trouble during the landing or the ascent from the lunar surface. There were 18 different variations of emergency rendezvous, and Collins had to learn how to fly them all. But even if he never needed his rendezvous cookbook, Collins would have to take care of docking the command ship with the lander, then removing the docking mechanism from the connecting tunnel. For the latter task, there was a horrendously long and opaque checklist loaded with terms like capture latch release handle lock. If he couldn't get the probe and drogue out of the tunnel, Collins would later write, "I was supposed to get out the toolkit and dismantle it. Me, who couldn't repair the latch on my screen door, I hated that probe and was half convinced it hated me and was going to prove it in lunar orbit by wedging itself intractably in the tunnel." If that happened, Collins knew, Armstrong and Aldrin would have to make a risky spacewalk to return to the command module. In Collins's mind, the 18 rendezvous scenarios and the probe and drogue swirled around twin responsibilities. He must get his crewmates back to Earth safely, and he must not do anything to screw up the mission. During the spring of 1969, Collins felt the eyes of the world upon him as he never had before, and his labors were tinged with anxiety. He also knew that Apollo 11 was putting a great strain on his wife, and that was something he wanted to stop as soon as possible. One day, when they were flying a T-38 to the Cape together, Deke Slayton offered to put Collins back in the rotation after Apollo 11. Collins knew he'd probably command one of the later lunar landings, but he declined Slayton's offer. He had already decided that, assuming it was successful, this flight would be his last. As the first weeks of June passed, Gene Kranz and his team had turned the corner. They had nearly mastered the challenges of the powered descent. They had firmed up the mission rules, critical guidelines for how to handle emergencies, and were becoming increasingly confident. But concern was mounting elsewhere, especially at NASA headquarters, where managers worried that the astronauts were tiring and would not be ready in time for a July launch. And there were moments when Armstrong had his doubts. It just seemed that there was too much to do before the scheduled launch date of July 16th. Should NASA postpone the mission until the next launch window in August? There wasn't much time to decide, because the Saturn V was on the pad, and technicians were getting ready to load propellants onto the lunar module and command ship. The hypergolic fuels used were too reactive to sit in the spacecraft's plumbing for more than a few weeks without risking corrosion. If NASA wanted to postpone the launch, they would have to decide soon. Deke Slayton came by the simulators at the Cape one day to find out how the astronauts saw things. Collins told Slayton he was ready, but he knew the burden rested on his crewmates. Aldrin did not want the training to stretch on indefinitely, feeling that they might be only marginally better by August. It came down to Armstrong. He told Slayton it would be tight, but they would be ready. On June 12th, after holding a 90-minute teleconference with Slayton, Wernher von Braun, Chris Kraft, and other Apollo managers, Apollo Program Director Sam Phillips made it official. Apollo 11 would leave Earth on July 16th as planned. Monday, June 16th, Ellington Air Force Base, Houston. A machine that looked like a strange, skeletal, prehistoric bird ascended into the muggy air at Ellington Air Force Base, whining and belching puffs of vapor like a possessed steam calliope. The machine turned and hovered in midair for an instant, then flew slowly over the concrete apron. This was the moment that made NASA managers chew their fingernails. Neil Armstrong was piloting the Lunar Landing Training Vehicle, one of the most unforgiving flying machines ever built. For Armstrong, it was also one of the most essential. It let him train to land on the moon. The LLTV looked as if it had been put together at an aerospace garage sale. A crisscross of metal struts with no skin formed the body of the craft, leaving fuel tanks, engines, and plumbing fully exposed. Four legs stuck out like a bedstead. The key to the trainer was that it had two independent means of propulsion. A jet engine supported 5/6 of its airborne weight. Armstrong didn't concern himself with the jet, but maneuvered the LLTV using a pair of rocket engines powered by hydrogen peroxide gas that simulated the lunar module's descent engine. Small jets mounted around the LLTV's metal framework mimicked the LM's attitude control thrusters. In May 1968, Armstrong had ejected from an earlier version of the trainer when it ran out of attitude control fuel and became unstable. The accident board traced the incident to a design flaw. No sooner had that problem been solved than NASA test pilot Joe Algranti bailed out of the new LLTV in December. This time it was an aerodynamic problem. Bob Gilruth was pressing Slayton not to let any more astronauts fly it. But Slayton resisted, saying he would sure as hell rather risk losing one at Ellington than above the surface of the moon. And Armstrong agreed, knowing that only the LLTV could prepare him for the last few hundred feet of the powered descent. Throughout the past few days, Armstrong had piloted the unwieldy craft. At an altitude of a few hundred feet, he activated the lunar simulation mode, and the LLTV flew just as if it were in a vacuum and in the moon's pull. Almost every instinct Armstrong had developed from a lifetime of flying airplanes was wrong now. The LLTV was balanced on the thrust of its rocket engine, like a dinner plate on a magician's broomstick. To start moving in one direction, Armstrong had to tilt the LLTV slightly, letting the rocket engine push him where he wanted to go. Because of the 1/6 G, he had to tilt the craft 6 times as far as he would have in normal gravity. He had to be careful not to tilt too far, or would risk falling out of the sky. At the same time, with the engine's thrust pointed off to one side, he had to ride the throttle in order to keep from losing altitude. And once he started moving, he would keep going, just as if he were flying in a vacuum. To arrest his motion, he had to tilt the LLTV in the opposite direction. Simply changing his landing point a few dozen feet became an act of supreme coordination. The thing that most surprised Armstrong when he first flew the LLTV was how sluggish it was. Each maneuver had to be anticipated well in advance because it took a surprisingly long time to get going and just as long to stop. To make matters even more difficult, the LLTV carried enough fuel for only about 6.5 minutes of flight. Each simulated landing lasted 3 or 4 minutes at most. It was precisely because the LLTV was so unforgiving that it was invaluable to Armstrong. It conditioned him to the fast time clock once more, for each time Armstrong brought the LLTV down, he knew that his fuel supply was dwindling, that each maneuver skirted the edge of the machine's stability, and that he had only one chance to make it. In a setting no more exotic than Ellington Air Force Base, he had to play it for keeps, just as he would in the airless sky of the moon. The LLTV drifted slowly over the runway, no faster than a car pulling into a garage. To those watching from the flight line, it was an eerie sight. as if it were controlled by some force originating beyond the steamy midday air. Finally, the machine started straight down, slowly, like a dragonfly deciding whether to alight. At last, the spindly craft came gently to rest. Ground technicians informed Armstrong that he had only 90 seconds worth of fuel left. "I understand," he answered, and lifted off on another run. By day's end, he had completed 8 flights in the machine. He was confident now that when the time came for the real thing, he would be ready. Ironically, Armstrong and Aldrin had little time to study the world they would visit. Armstrong was clearly interested in the science of his mission, and the geologists had long considered him a promising student. For Apollo 11, he made time in the overcrowded training schedule for a field trip to the mountains of westernmost Texas. The press found out in advance and almost turned it into a circus. They followed the astronauts' cars with a caravan of their own. Time magazine hired a helicopter that roared overhead and made it nearly impossible for Armstrong and Aldrin to hear what the geologists were saying. Aside from that one outing, they depended on briefings by geologists from the Manned Spacecraft Center and from the U.S. Geological Survey in Flagstaff, Arizona. Armstrong also asked scientist astronaut Jack Schmidt to act as their liaison with the scientific community. As Armstrong made a point of saying at a pre-flight press conference, the surface of the moon was not an unknown place in the strictest sense, thanks to the unmanned lunar orbiter and surveyor probes. But even with the naked eye, it's easy to see 2 different types of terrain on the lunar near side. The dark splotches called Maria, the Latin word for seas, and the bright highlands, which scientists call the Terrae. A good pair of binoculars revealed that the Maria are relatively smooth compared to the heavily pockmarked highlands, and by 1969, most geologists agreed that if Armstrong and Aldrin managed to touch down on Mare Tranquillitatis, the Sea of Tranquility, they would find an ancient lava plain made of basalts like those found in Hawaii and other volcanic locales, and judging by the pictures sent back from the surveyor landers, they would also find what was apparently a ubiquitous layer of fine-grained debris, probably formed by the continuous rain of meteorites over the eons. But when it came down to it, the probes could only radio back numbers. They could not completely dispel the aura of mystery around the moon, even in the minds of some scientists. And there were some dire predictions. Cornell astronomer Thomas Gold insisted that the moon was covered by a layer of fluffy powder dozens of feet thick. He warned that the LM would sink out of sight as soon as it touched down. He told NASA that Armstrong and Aldrin should drop brightly colored weights as they descended and watch to see that they remained in view, or else abort the landing. None of his colleagues, not even pictures from the surveyors resting unharmed on the surface, could dissuade him. Other forecasts were harder to refute. One theory emerged that charged particles emanating from the sun had so altered the rocks over eons that they would burst into flames as soon as they were exposed to oxygen inside the lunar module. No one would know the answer until it happened, and no amount of speculation could answer the question of whether there was life on the moon. No geologist thought there was. It offered an almost unimaginably hostile environment, devoid of air and water, exposed to the vacuum of space, bathed in deadly solar and cosmic radiation, pelted incessantly by micrometeorites. One geologist pointed out that if he wanted to build a sterilization machine, he would construct something like the surface of the moon. And yet, the implications if even one microbe survived the trip back to Earth on a spacesuit or under a fingernail were so unsettling that NASA could not ignore the possibility, especially when voiced by several U.S. government agencies and other countries. NASA constructed an $8 million lunar receiving laboratory at the Space Center to store the lunar samples in total biological isolation and house the astronauts in the last 2 weeks of a 21-day quarantine, while officials nervously waited to see if they came down with any symptoms. Quarantine was something Armstrong and his crew would just as soon have done without, but they had no choice. The weak link in the plan was that no one had figured a way to get the astronauts from the command module to the LRL without exposing them briefly to the environment. A special quarantine trailer would house them for the trip from the Pacific back to Texas, but that left getting from the command module to the trailer. That's where the biological isolation garments came in. After splashdown, the astronauts would open the command module hatch just long enough to let the recovery swimmers toss in 3 BIGs. After zipping them on, the men would climb into the waiting life rafts, scrub each other with disinfectant, and descend to the helicopter in the recovery net. From then on, they would be in quarantine. There would be no speeches on the carrier deck. After a short walk from the helicopter to the quarantine trailer, they would close the door behind themselves and view the world through a pane of glass, there and in the LRL, until the quarantine was ended. In the first days of July 1969, that moment seemed all too distant. Saturday, July 5th, 1969, Manned Spacecraft Center, Houston. With just 11 days to go until launch, Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins spent the July 4th weekend at home, a last visit with their families before heading to the Cape. There had been precious little time off these past 7 months. Even their time at home was often claimed. A specialist would come by to give an informal briefing. Evenings were spent holed up in the study with flight plans and training documents. Most of the time, though, they weren't even home. Life's July 4th issue, with the cover story, Off to the Moon, included the customary report from the home front. Armstrong fishing with his sons, baking homemade pizza, and playing piano duets with his wife Jan. Collins trimming roses in the backyard. Aldrin taking his kids to Astro World. But the truth was, those things would never have happened if an outing with family hadn't been a PR requirement. Since January, Slayton had tried to keep the press at a distance, simply because Armstrong's crew had so much training to pack in. Even so, the men had made time for this or that reporter to come by the house and ask questions about their lives and their mission. Finally, Slayton gave in and agreed to a last press conference, and Armstrong's crew spent most of Saturday, July 5th, talking to the media. At this point, the men were well into their 21-day pre-mission medical quarantine, and so on this summer afternoon they strolled onto the stage wearing hospital masks and did not remove them until they had taken their places inside a plastic-enclosed booth. A few reporters grinned back at them from behind their own masks. One asked whether any precautions had been taken to prevent the men from catching germs from their own families. Collins answered, "My wife and children have signed a statement that they have no germs. Seriously, there are no special precautions being taken." But the journalists directed few questions to Collins. They were much more interested in his crewmates, and especially his commander. For 7 months now, Armstrong had been telling interviewers that he wished the press would convey that Apollo 11 was a massive group effort, that it was a mistake to focus on him, but he had not been successful. At the press conference, one reporter suggested to him that, as the first man to set foot on the moon, he would be so famous that his personal life would cease to exist. He added, "Do you have any thoughts on this prospect?" "I suppose," Armstrong said, smiling shyly, speaking in characteristically measured words, "if there is any recognizable disadvantage to being in the position I'm in, then that's it. I think that's a fair trade." On Monday, July 7th, Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins headed back to the Cape for the last time. For the next 9 days, their world was a high-tech monastery, equally divided between the simulators and the crew quarters. Richard Nixon had planned to visit them here on the night before launch to have dinner, but canceled after Chuck Berry publicly fretted that he might infect the astronauts. Privately, Armstrong and his crew fumed about the gaffe. The president was no more likely to harbor germs than the dozens of people they worked with every day. For Mike Collins, the incident was a momentary distraction from the awesome sense of responsibility for the mission he was about to fly. That pressure was very much on the mind of NASA Administrator Tom Paine when he dined in the crew quarters on Thursday, July 10th. Over dinner, Paine made an extraordinary promise to Armstrong's crew. Don't take any unnecessary risks to accomplish the mission, he told them. If anything should go wrong, don't hesitate to abort. He would see to it that they would not have to get back in line for another flight. They would be assigned to the very next mission to try again. For Collins, Payne's promise took some of the pressure off, but not for Neil Armstrong. He was only too aware that the nation's prestige was riding on this mission. It was impossible not to be aware, in the fishbowl they'd been living in since January, and although he felt ready, and sensed that Collins and Aldrin did too, he knew also that the landing would test the entire Apollo system, the hardware, the mission control teams, and themselves, to the limit. Even on the morning of July 16, 1969, as Armstrong led his crew out into the TV lights and onto the transfer van, with an old comb and a package of lifesavers in the pocket of his spacesuit, he had little doubt they would make it safely back to Earth. But the landing, in his mind, was still a 50-50 proposition. Chapter 5. The First Lunar Landing, Apollo 11. 1. The Eagle Has Landed. Saturday, July 19th, 1969, 5:30 a.m. Houston time, 2 days, 21 hours mission elapsed time, aboard Apollo 11, 177,000 miles from Earth. Buzz Aldrin opened his eyes and floated in the darkness, collecting his thoughts, remembering where he was. All was still inside the command module Columbia. Only the hum of the cabin fans broke the total silence of the void. Every so often, strange flashes appeared. Aldrin did not know what they were, but they seemed to be something actually entering the cabin. Perhaps a vagabond cosmic particle decaying in the command module's atmosphere. He had seen the flashes last night, too. Now he made a mental note to mention them to Armstrong and Collins. They were still asleep, down in their sleeping bags. Aldrin had spent the night up in his couch on the right-hand side with a lightweight headset taped to his ear, in case Houston tried to call during the night. Nobody kept watches on a space flight anymore. Ever since Apollo 8, they had done away with that in the interest of getting better sleep. On this mission especially, sleep was important. They had agreed before they left the Earth, he and Armstrong and Collins, to take it easy on the way out to the moon, knowing that it would be a mistake to arrive in lunar orbit tired the way Borman, Lovell, and Anders had. It came down to a state of mind. They would convince themselves, as they coasted out to the moon, that the mission had not really begun, and that it would not begin until the moment when Armstrong and Aldrin floated into the lunar module Eagle, undocked from Columbia, and started the final descent to the moon. Aldrin was up early. The end of the rest period wasn't for another 2 hours, but he knew they would be reaching the moon in about 7 hours, and he wanted to know whether they would be making a last mid-course correction before they got there. He keyed his mic. Houston, Apollo 11. Aldrin heard only static. He guessed that one of the tracking stations was about to go out of contact, carried by the Earth's rotation, and that the manned spaceflight network was in the process of switching to another big dish. He lifted the shade from Columbia's right-hand window and looked for Earth, but outside there was only dull, starless black. It would have been a tall order, pretending the mission hadn't started yet, if Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins hadn't flown before. They knew what it was to work in a strange and hostile environment. None of them had any trouble with motion sickness on the way out. On the contrary, Aldrin thought floating inside the command module was even more fun than spacewalking, for it offered all the freedom of movement with none of the limitations of a pressurized spacesuit. With Eagle attached to the command module's nose, Apollo 11 was like a small, two-room space station. The two joined craft coasted moonward, twirling slowly in the sun's glare. Aldrin hadn't gone inside Eagle until the day before, when he and Armstrong made a scheduled inspection of his cabin. He'd gone in first, making the topsy-turvy passage up from the command module and down into the lander. He would later call it the strangest sensation of the entire voyage. It was Aldrin's first time inside Eagle in 2 weeks, and it felt good to be back. Armstrong arrived, hanging from the ceiling by Aldrin's reckoning, with the television camera. Before the flight, they had barely enough time to learn how to turn the camera on, never mind learn how to point it accurately or stage anything like a professional-looking show. It was challenging, to say the least. When Mission Control came on the air 10 minutes before a TV show started and announced, matter-of-factly, that 200 million people were standing by for the broadcast, they're all watching. Now, what are you going to show us? But this one went well. For most of it, Aldrin was on camera, giving his audience a look at various items of equipment. A movie camera they would use to film the powered descent. A flight plan. One of the protective visors he and Armstrong would wear during the moonwalk. From what Charlie Duke in Mission Control said, the TV show was an unqualified success. Much of the world picked it up live, and the picture was so clear you could read labels on the instrument panel. But such diversions aside, Aldrin hadn't felt quite on top of things since they left Earth. There was that feeling of being slightly behind the airplane that he'd had as a squadron pilot whenever he flew a new jet for the first time. Even though everything was going smoothly, even though he was doing things he had done literally hundreds of times in the simulator, it was the reality of it all, seeing the Earth beyond the windows, floating free, knowing that the world was listening and watching almost everything they did, that put him just slightly off balance. And there was always another performance ahead, whether it was a mid-course correction burn or a television show. Houston, Apollo 11. This time there was an answer. It was Ron Evans, the Capcom, who was working the night shift. With the three of them asleep, Evans's shift got pretty dull, and he sounded glad to make contact. He told Aldrin the trajectory was so good that there wasn't going to be a mid-course and he could go back to sleep for another couple of hours, so Aldrin settled in and tried, without success, to sleep again. After a few minutes, he was aware of some activity beneath the couches. Armstrong and Collins were awake. They shed their lightweight sleeping bags, emerged from behind the seats, and the three men began the business of their fourth day in space. Fuel cells needed to be purged. There was breakfast to fix. And there was an unspoken but undeniable tension in Columbia's cabin. Each of them could feel it. The ruse was getting harder and harder to pull off. They were about to put their lives and their abilities on the line. Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins had not seen the moon on the way out. But according to the flight plan, they were supposed to take some pictures of it a few hours before breaking into lunar orbit. As they finished breakfast, a sudden darkness came around them, and for the first time in the flight, the sky was full of stars, too many to count, each with a steady, gem-like brilliance. They had flown into the lunar shadow. Through the windows of the slowly turning spacecraft, they looked out at the place where the sun had once been, and there was the moon, a huge, magnificent sphere bathed in the eerie blue light of Earthshine, each crater rendered in ghostly detail, all except for a third of the globe, which was a crescent of blackness. As their eyes adapted to the darkness, they saw that the entire moon was set against a gigantic ellipse of pearly white light, the glowing gases of the sun's outer atmosphere, which stretched beyond the moon into the blackness. Somehow, in these strange cosmic illuminations, the moon looked decidedly three-dimensional, bulging out at them as if to present itself in welcome, or, perhaps, warning. 7:25 p.m. Houston time, 3 days, 10 hours, 53 minutes mission elapsed time. Even before Apollo 11 left Earth, Neil Armstrong knew the approach to his landing site as well as he had known the desert towns along the approach to Edwards. he'd spent some of the quiet hours of the trip out to the moon studying the photographs radioed from the unmanned probes and carried back aboard Apollo 10. Now that he was in lunar orbit, and he could look down on the Sea of Tranquility with his own eyes, Eagle's landing approach was even easier to recognize than Stafford and Cernan's pictures had suggested. The very moment of Apollo 11's departure from Earth had been timed so that tomorrow, during the landing, the sun would be 10 degrees above the horizon, throwing the mare into relief, so that he would be able to spot rough ground as he flew Eagle to a landing. Landing Site 2 was an ellipse measuring 11.5 miles by 3 miles, or about as long as Manhattan Island and half again as wide. There were many places that were more exciting, geologically speaking, but they were also much riskier or harder to get to. On later landings, there would be time to explore. For now, the geologists would be happy with any place Armstrong and Aldrin managed to visit, and so Site 2, chosen for its blandness, was a completely unremarkable stretch of mare, close to the lunar equator and thus easiest to reach. Only Stafford and Cernan had seen it close up, but that was from 9 miles. What would it look like from 500 feet? Would it offer a safe place to land a lunar module? Armstrong was cautiously optimistic. Soon enough, he would find out for certain. Late in the day, while Aldrin went into Eagle to make systems checks, Armstrong lingered at Columbia's window, hoping to glimpse the landing site itself. Below, a crater called Moltke, only a few miles wide, glowed in the light of lunar dawn. Around it, the mare was cut by flat, narrow valleys like desert roads. Just to the north, almost enveloped by night, lay the place where he and Aldrin would try to land. Collins asked, "Can you see the landing site?" Armstrong peered down among the long shadows. "I'm not sure," he said. Suddenly he and Collins heard Aldrin's voice in their headsets. "I can see it," Aldrin said from inside Eagle, contained excitement in his voice. "I got the whole landing site here." After a moment, Armstrong and Collins could see it too, barely emerged from the shadows. From this height, landing site too was tiny, but it was possible to make out some details. And it didn't look encouraging. In this illumination, with even the tiniest features thrown into jagged relief, it looked so forbidding as to be untenable. It was difficult to accept that while they slept that night, the rising sun would tame this unsettling scene. Right now, it looked like the last place anyone would want to land. 8:32 p.m. "Amazing how quickly you adapt," Collins said brightly at dinner. "Why, it doesn't seem weird at all to me to look out there and see the moon going by, you know?" But behind his calm words, Collins harbored unspoken concern for his crewmates. He could not tell whether they felt anxiety, for they seemed entirely relaxed. Of the three of them, he was least comfortable with the risks they were undertaking, most conscious of the fallibility of complex machines. He had come to see the flight as a long and fragile daisy chain of events, and was only too aware that at any time the chain could break. Now he felt something like an anxious parent with 2 children about to go away on a long trip. He offered to take the watch for the night, encouraging Armstrong and Aldrin to sleep underneath their couches. "You guys ought to get a good night's sleep going into that damn LM." As his crewmates readied their supplies for the next morning, Collins said flatly, "I thought today went pretty well. If tomorrow and the next day are like today, we'll be safe." Sunday, July 20th, 12:18 p.m., Houston time. 4 days, 3 hours, 46 minutes mission elapsed time. "You cats take it easy on the lunar surface. If I hear you huffing and puffing, I'm going to start bitching at you." Collins's gentle admonition came as Columbia and Eagle coasted through another sun-drenched orbital noon, with undocking only minutes away. When the time came, Collins pushed the button to release the LM and called out, "Okay, there you go. Beautiful." Pushed by the spring action of the docking mechanism, the 2 craft drifted apart. Armstrong carefully steadied Eagle with a few quick bursts of thruster fire. For several minutes, Eagle and Columbia drifted in formation, orbiter and lander, robot spider face to face with command ship. Collins fired off pictures as the lander turned a slow pirouette before him. "I think you've got a fine-looking flying machine there, Eagle," Collins offered, "despite the fact you're upside down." "Somebody's upside down," Armstrong said. "You guys take care," Collins radioed. Armstrong replied simply, "See you later." Collins gave a short burst of the maneuvering thrusters, and Columbia pulled away until Eagle was merely a point of light. Collins had given some thought to the chances of accomplishing this mission, and he had independently arrived at the same 50-50 odds as his commander. For the next few hours, he had work to do, tracking Eagle's flight over the craters and relaying this information to Houston. But when it came time for the powered descent, he would simply listen, like everyone else. 2:35 p.m., Houston time. Missions Operations Control Room, Manned Spacecraft Center. It was quiet in Mission Control, the way it almost always was during a mission. At the front of the room, a giant screen showed a green-colored map of the moon with a tiny moving command module and LM. It showed that Columbia and Eagle were flying over the far side, out of radio contact. Already, the controllers had passed up the data to Eagle for the descent orbit insertion burn and the powered descent. Soon the spacecraft would reappear, and if all had gone according to plan, Eagle would be on its way down to 50,000 feet. Gene Kranz and his team of flight controllers, they were called the White Team, sat at their consoles, wearing lightweight headsets, anticipating the acquisition of signal. For the moment, their television screens, normally full of up-to-the-minute data, were static. Behind the controllers, in a glassed-in gallery that looked out over the control room, NASA managers, current and former astronauts, and other VIPs crowded together to witness the drama to come. Just looking at them drove home the fact that this was not a simulation. In the third row of the MOCR, Gene Kranz sat at the flight director's console wearing a brand-new white vest. When he was on shift, he always wore a white vest, made for him by his wife, Marta. This one was white brocade with silver thread. It was a special vest for a special occasion. To Kranz, it seemed as though months had passed since the trials of June, but in the last weeks they had finally mastered the powered descent. By launch time, Kranz knew he had a winning team. From the time he had awakened this morning, Kranz was sure that Armstrong and Aldrin would land on the moon today. He had gone to church, and then to his office, where he had played his Sousa tapes. A few minutes after 8 that morning, he took the flight director's chair in Mission Control to begin the shift for the descent phase. He felt unwavering confidence in the spacecraft, the astronauts, and most of all in his men. In his mind, it was crucial that he exude that confidence. Kranz looked down from his console to the first row of the MOCR, the place the flight controllers called the trench. There was Bob Carlton, who watched the LM descent engine like a hawk. His call sign on the loop was Control. Jerry Bostick was FIDO, for Flight Dynamics Officer. He would monitor the tracking data as the LM descended. And Steve Bales, the expert on the LM's guidance system, who would be called Guidance. At 26, Bales was no younger than many of his fellow controllers, but he seemed especially boyish. It was his enthusiasm, his slightly unkempt looks. It was Bales's job to keep tabs on the LM's computer, landing radar, and its trajectory down to the moon. Off to Kranz's right, in the MOCR's second row, a half-dozen other men rounded out the team, keeping track of the other systems aboard the LM. Each controller, plugged into his own back-room specialists, funneled data and advice to Kranz in the third row, and directly in front of him, there was astronaut Charlie Duke, The young South Carolinian whose drawl had answered the excited reports from a barnstorming Tom Stafford and Gene Cernan. Charlie Duke knew more about the lunar module than any astronaut who wasn't already on an Apollo crew. That expertise had prompted Neil Armstrong to ask him to serve as CAPCOM for the landing. A short time ago, Kranz had ordered security to lock the doors to the MOCR. Then he'd switched to a separate communications loop, one that the VIPs and the pool reporter couldn't hear, and talked to his men. "Okay, gang, we've had a good training period," he began. "And today, we're really going to do it. We're going to land on the moon. This is the final exam." He reviewed the key milestones of the powered descent and made sure his controllers were clear on their own ground rules for feeding him information over the loop. Then Kranz gave a pep talk worthy of a battlefield commander. "This is the best team I've ever worked with," he said. "I have ultimate confidence in you people. What we're about to do now, it's just like we do it in training. And after we finish the son of a gun, we're gonna go out and have a beer and say, 'Damn it, we really did something.'" 2:46 p.m. Telemetry readouts streamed into the control center as Columbia came out from behind the moon. Seconds later, Kranz heard Mike Collins tell Charlie Duke, "Listen, babe, everything's going just swimmingly." Almost 2 minutes passed before Eagle reappeared, and almost immediately communications with the LM became spotty. The signal would drop out and then return. Kranz sweated out the interruptions, knowing that only minutes from now he would have to give Armstrong and Aldrin a go-ahead for the powered descent, and when that time came, his controllers would have to have good data. How much data was a judgment call that only Kranz could make. If everything was going well, they could get by with only a few seconds' worth, but even if things were bad, Kranz was willing to stretch rules because he knew the risks entailed in an abort. Several astronauts were seated next to Duke, listening in. One of them was Pete Conrad. He suggested to Duke that Eagle yaw slightly to one side to improve the signal strength. That worked. 3:06 p.m. Inside Eagle, 50,000 feet above the moon, Armstrong and Aldrin stood side by side, anchored by harnesses to the LM floor. Four-day beards darkened their faces. Within their bubble helmets, they scanned the instrument panel as the time for powered descent approached. Their mouths were dry from the pure oxygen flowing through their spacesuits. Already they had pressurized Eagle's fuel tanks, called up the proper computer program, and checked their trajectory by sighting on the sun with the LM's navigation telescope. With 40 seconds to go, Armstrong made sure that Aldrin had turned on the movie camera to record the descent. Armstrong set the switch to arm the descent engine. Then, seconds after Aldrin pushed the proceed button, the two men spoke at once. "Ignition." "Just about on time," Armstrong said. The descent engine came to life so gently that Armstrong and Aldrin heard and felt nothing. Only the gauges told Armstrong it was firing. Less than half a minute later, it roared to full thrust and the cabin filled with a soundless, high-frequency vibration. Once more, communications dropped out. "They've lost you," Collins radioed to his crewmates. A moment later, after Aldrin switched to a different antenna, communications returned. Now, Neil Armstrong turned his attention to the moon. Eagle was face down, and through his small, triangular window, Armstrong could see landmarks he recognized. Each checkpoint was appearing 2 full seconds ahead of schedule, and since Eagle was going nearly a mile a second, that meant they would come down about 2 miles beyond their aim point. Armstrong keyed his mic. "Our position checks downrange show us to be a little long," he radioed to Earth. Now Eagle's engine throttled down. Exactly on schedule, and Armstrong realized the computer was not aware of the error. The long break continued, and now, 46,000 feet above the moon, It was time for Armstrong to turn Eagle over on its back so that its landing radar would point at the moon. When he did, he and Aldrin found themselves looking out at the Earth, afloat in blackness. At 40,000 feet, the landing radar came to life, blurting information on speed and altitude to Eagle's computer. From these data, the computer continually revised its trajectory calculations, and Eagle shuddered with corrective bursts from the maneuvering jets. Armstrong was surprised to hear them fire so often, much more often than in the simulator. No smooth ride at this stage. They were lurching their way down to the moon. Aldrin, meanwhile, began a running dialogue with the computer, checking its height calculations against the data from the radar. As expected, the two disagreed by several thousand feet. Aldrin knew the radar echoes were more reliable, and he planned to tell the computer to accept those data, but first he wanted Mission Control to take a look. To do that, he keyed in a command to tell the computer to display the difference, or Delta H, as it was called. Suddenly, the men heard the high-pitched buzz of the master alarm in their ears. On the computer display, the probe light glowed amber. "Program alarm," Armstrong radioed. It was the crispness of his words, rather than the tone of his voice, that conveyed urgency. Quickly, Aldrin queried the computer for the alarm code, and 1202 flashed on the display. Aldrin did not know just what 1202 meant, and this was not the time to dig out the data book to find out, but it had something to do with the computer being overloaded with too many things to do. He had never seen this kind of alarm in a descent simulation. Now he wished it would just go away. In Mission Control, Gene Kranz felt as if he were in one of those bad simulations back in the dark days of early June. He had almost been glad when the problems began as soon as Eagle came around the moon, beginning with the spotty communications. Kranz welcomed a little adversity at the starting gun. It would get his men thinking instead of waiting tensely. A few malfunctions made the whole thing seem more like a simulation and less like history, but the problems snowballed. Even as the powered descent began, critical data from the spacecraft kept cutting out, then returning for brief moments, just barely long enough for Kranz to let the landing continue. In the midst of it all, Kranz had done what he called going around the horn, polling his men. He knew their voices so well that he could pick them out in the web of simultaneous conversations filling his headset. As each man spoke, Kranz listened for signs of strain. He heard solidity, and none more so than young Steve Bales, the LM computer expert, who came back with such unbridled enthusiasm, "Go!" that Kranz almost burst out laughing. Now, with the LM's computer threatening to abort the landing, Bales was his most important man. Back in the first week of July, the same kind of computer alarms had come up during a simulation with the Apollo 12 crew. Kranz had ordered an abort, and afterward the simulation instructors had really let him have it. If he had only been familiar with the alarms, they told him, he could have kept going. For the rest of that day and that night, Kranz sat down with Bales and some of the computer experts from MIT, studying each type of alarm and what to do if it came up. So when Kranz heard Neil Armstrong call 1202, he knew it was serious. Whether they could continue or not was up to Steve Bales. But the complexities of the LM's computer were too much for one person. Bales wasn't certain what the 1202 alarm meant. He put the question to one of his backroom experts, Jack Garman. Garman knew that for some reason, no one knew why, Eagle's computer was saying, "I have too many things to do in my computation cycle, so I'm going to give up and start at the top of the list." As Kranz waited for an answer from Bales, he heard Armstrong tensely radio, "Give us a reading on the 1202 program alarm." Before Kranz could speak, Bales responded, We're go on that. Flight." Garman had told Bales that as long as the alarm was intermittent, not continuous, everything would be okay. But if the alarm returned and didn't go away, the computer could give up working altogether, and that would mean an almost certain abort. Inside Eagle, Armstrong and Aldrin heard Charlie Duke's urgent but assured words, "We're go on that alarm." Once more, Aldrin queried the computer for the Delta H. Once more, an alarm rang in their headsets. Again, a message from Steve Bales came to them via Charlie Duke. Mission Control would keep tabs on the Delta H, alleviating some of the computer's workload. Above the moon and in Houston, everyone hoped the fix would work. Halfway through the powered descent, right on schedule, Eagle's computer throttled the engine back to half its maximum power. Suddenly, Armstrong and Aldrin felt themselves grow lighter. The long break was over now. It was time for Eagle to pitch over from its face-up position and begin the final descent. Armstrong and Aldrin waited intently for the computer to execute the maneuver. Just as planned, 7,500 feet up, Eagle's maneuvering thrusters fired to pitch the craft forward. In Eagle's windows, the flat horizon swung upward into view, and Armstrong looked out at the cratered plains of the Sea of Tranquility, bright in morning sunlight. Armstrong checked the altitude and speed. 5,000 feet up, 100 feet per second, just as expected. For a moment, he took control of his craft, pulsed the maneuvering thrusters, then gave the ship back to the computer, satisfied that Eagle would respond when it was time for him to take over. Now his eyes went back to the gauges. 3,000 feet up now, descending at 70 feet per second, about 48 miles an hour. Eagle was right on the planned trajectory. He heard Duke say, "You are go for landing." This was the time for Armstrong to watch for his landmarks and look for a good place to set down. Before he could do so, Aldrin announced, "Program alarm, 1201. In Houston, Steve Bales was ready. Before Kranz could finish asking him what 1201 meant, Bales shot back, "Same type, we're go." Inside Eagle, Armstrong's eyes went back to the moonscape. He gazed past the grid on his window and said to Aldrin, "Give me an LPD." Aldrin queried the computer and told Armstrong, 47 degrees. 47, Armstrong repeated. He sighted along the window grid past the 47-degree mark. He could see the target, still more than a mile in the distance, but advancing rapidly. It looked promising. "That's not a bad-looking area," he said blandly. Suddenly, the alarm was back. Aldrin had no sooner cleared the alarm than it sounded again. Again, Armstrong's attention was diverted by the threat of an abort, while Eagle flew onward. When the alarms quieted down, the moon was only 1,000 feet below him, and he did not like what he saw. A crater as big as a football field was just ahead, surrounded by a field of boulders some as big as Volkswagens. The computer was blindly taking them there, down into the middle of the boulder field, and for an instant, Armstrong weighed the matter. He was all but certain those boulders would prove to be pieces of lunar bedrock. If he could find a safe place to land just short of the boulders, he and Aldrin would no doubt find some prizes for the geologists. But Eagle was going too fast. There were just too many rocks. It was time for him to take over. He switched to attitude hold and pitched the lander forward until it was almost level, letting the descent rocket break its fall without slowing its horizontal flight. Only 350 feet up now, Eagle skimmed over the boulders and headed toward safer ground. Armstrong planned to set down on the first clear place he could find. Buzz Aldrin did not know about the crater or the boulders, and he heard nothing from Armstrong, who was too busy flying to get out more than a few clipped words every now and then, and Aldrin was too busy to look out the window. His eyes went back and forth between the gauges and the computer readout. His hands went to the computer's keyboard to extract the critical information, and his voice, heard on hot mic by Armstrong and the listening world, was a steady stream of data. 350 feet, down at 4, 330, 6.5 down, you're pegged on horizontal velocity. His voice was almost electronic. In mission control, Kranz and his controllers heard only Aldrin's stream of numbers. Telemetry told them that Armstrong had assumed semi-manual control of the lunar module. No one knew about the football field-sized crater. They knew only that Eagle was no longer following the nominal landing profile, that it had slowed its descent and was still moving at a good clip over the moon. Gene Kranz knew then that the partnership had all but dissolved, that the center of gravity of the decision-making process was no longer some point midway between himself and the moon. It was Neil Armstrong. Charlie Duke knew it too, and he said over the loop to Kranz, "I think we'd better be quiet." There was nothing to do but listen to Aldrin's voice and hope that the fuel held out. Armstrong flew onward, sharing control of Eagle with the computer. As he cleared the big crater, he was careful to pitch Eagle back again to avoid building up too much speed. Below, he could see a string of boulders. He banked slightly to the left to get away from them. The response was sluggish and familiar. The lunar module was a much better flying machine than he had expected, easier than any simulation. The little toggle switch to control their rate of descent, the one he had been skeptical of back on Earth, was working well. Now Armstrong pushed it several times to slow their fall. The moon rushed up at him, new terrain advancing quickly over the horizon. He heard Aldrin, 300 feet, down 3.5, 47 forward. His heart pounded. Still there was no clear place. The clock seemed to race. He had to buy time to search for a spot. Armstrong slowed Eagle's descent rate. "How's the fuel?" Armstrong's voice was quiet, even relaxed. 8%. Aldrin answered. That was less than they'd had in the simulations. Now, at last, Armstrong saw what looked like a patch of smooth ground just ahead. "Okay," Armstrong said. "Looks like a good area here." Aldrin stole a moment to glance out. On the bright ground, 250 feet below, was a dark silhouette clearly recognizable as a lunar module, bristling with antennae and landing gear and ringed with a halo of sunlight. Then he went back to the gauges, his voice more insistent as he fed Armstrong data. 220 feet, 13 forward, 11 forward, coming down nicely. Now Armstrong saw that the place he had selected was no good. "I'm going right over a crater," he said, his words lost in Aldrin's numbers. "I gotta get farther over here." Again he nudged the hand controller forward, leveling the craft, using the last bit of forward speed to clear the crater, and just beyond it he saw where he was going to land. It was a smooth, level place about 200 feet square, bounded on one side by a few large craters and on the other by a line of boulders. He knew they were getting very low on fuel. As if to emphasize this, the descent quantity light now glowed on the instrument panel. 90 seconds of fuel left, and 20 seconds of that had to be saved for an abort. But Armstrong had his landing place, and only 100 feet separated Eagle from the moon. It was crucial to bring Eagle straight down with no horizontal motion. Otherwise, there was the risk that the touchdown might break off a landing leg. Armstrong trained his vision on a place just beyond the landing point, which he would use as a reference to judge Eagle's height and motion all the way to touchdown. Now he noticed that everything was wrapped in a transparent haze. The blast of the rocket was disturbing the dust of the moon. As Eagle descended, the haze became a sheet of rushing streaks that flew away from him in all directions, obscuring the surface. They confused his perception of motion like a fast-moving ground fog blowing across a runway, but he could see rocks on the surface sticking up through the blur like islands, and he fixed his gaze on them. Armstrong clicked the rate of descent toggle until Eagle descended no faster than an elevator. He focused on the rocks and on Aldrin's numbers. 60 feet, down 2.5, 2 forward, 2 forward. He heard Charlie Duke's voice. 60 seconds. A minute's worth of fuel left until he and Aldrin would be forced to abort. In mission control, stomachs tightened. No one knew about the big crater and Armstrong's efforts to avoid it. They knew only that in almost every simulation Armstrong had landed by this point, and everyone, from the controllers riveted to their displays to the VIPs who watched in agonized silence, knew that every second brought Armstrong and Aldrin closer to their abort limit. Even now, it was impossible to know how it would end. 50 feet above the moon. Now, 30. Eagle was drifting slowly backward, and Armstrong did not know why, but he knew he must not land while he could not see where he was going. He pulsed the hand controller, struggling to arrest the unwanted motion. He was displeased with himself, sure that he was not flying Eagle smoothly. He wished he could buy more time, but he was too low on fuel to slow the descent any further. 20 feet to go. He'd stopped the backward drift, but still wrestled with a sideways motion that had crept in. They were flying the dead man's curve now, too low to abort if the engine quit. But in the back of his mind, Armstrong knew that if that happened, they'd be okay. They would just fall onto the moon. Dust blew furiously. Once more words of caution came from Earth. 30 seconds. Then Buzz Aldrin said, "Contact light." Armstrong had planned to shut the engine down at this moment. The engineers had warned him that if the rocket got too close to the surface, the back pressure from its own exhaust might blow it up. But he was so absorbed in flying that he forgot about that. With the engine still firing, Eagle settled onto the moon so gently that neither man sensed the contact. Quickly, Armstrong hit the engine stop button and said, "Shut down." Now, there was a blur of activity as Armstrong and Aldrin set switches and keyed numbers into the computer while Aldrin rattled off the post-landing checklist. Descent engine command override off, engine arm off, 413 is in. Then there was a moment of quiet, and the two men turned to one another in the tiny cabin. Their eyes met. Their bearded faces grinned at each other inside bubble helmets, and their gloved hands clasped. Armstrong keyed his mic. "Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed." The answer from Earth was like a sigh of relief. "Roger, Tranquility, we copy you on the ground," radioed Charlie Duke. "You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot." They had done it. For an instant, Armstrong and Aldrin savored relief and elation that the greatest challenge was behind them. For Armstrong, it was more than a personal high. Hundreds of thousands of people had worked for the better part of a decade to share this triumph. And for himself, the landing had been everything a pilot could ask for. It had been a close call, but that just sweetened the victory. There was no way to know exactly how much fuel remained when they touched down. The gauges just weren't that accurate. But it was something like 20 seconds worth left before the abort limit. Of course, Armstrong knew 20 seconds is a long time. 2. Magnificent desolation. Tranquility Base, 3:17 p.m., Houston time. 4 days, 6 hours, 45 minutes mission elapsed time. Seconds after Eagle's rocket engine shut down, the dust particles departed on long, flat trajectories, and the stillness of a billion years returned to the Sea of Tranquility. Inside Eagle, Armstrong and Aldrin put their elation on hold. There was work to do. Now that they were on the moon, the most important thing was to get ready to leave it in case of an emergency. That meant checking Eagle's systems, entering abort data into the computer, and aligning the guidance platform to the weak lunar gravity. That last item was Aldrin's task, and while he attended to it, meticulously sighting on stars with the navigation telescope and conversing with the computer, Armstrong had a chance to survey the place where they had landed. Eagle had come to rest on a broad, level plain, pockmarked with craters a few dozen feet to a fraction of an inch across, and scattered with rocks and boulders. In the distance, Armstrong could see ridges that might have been 20 or 30 feet high, but it was hard to tell. There were no buildings, trees, or any other features normally used to judge size and distance. The lack of atmosphere gave an unreal clarity to the view, better than the clearest day on Earth. Hills and boulders at the horizon were as sharp as the rocks next to Eagle's footpads. Beyond that bright edge, as empty as the margins of a 15th-century map, was the blackness of space. Most amazing to Armstrong was the strange play of light and color. Directly ahead, to the west, the light of the rising sun was brilliantly reflected by a landscape of light tan. This gave way on either side to a dimmer, grayer tan, and when he craned to look off to the side, where the ground was crisscrossed with long morning shadows, he saw an ashen gray. It was not a hostile scene. Somehow it did not look like a place where an unprotected man would perish in seconds. On the contrary, it seemed inviting.